Welcome back to the program. For many of us baby boomers who grew up in the shadow of the Cold War and the nuclear age, we thought all of that ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union. It seemed as if the Cuban Missile Crisis 50 years ago was the apogee of our nuclear fear. But today, if we're paying attention, we see that the nuclear age has in fact spread. There are not 2, but 9 nuclear states in the world, and while it's certainly a lot less than the 25 that JFK thought we'd have by the 80s, it's enough to make the world of nuclear weapons 2.0 a very dangerous place. This is the launching pad for our guest Paul Bracken's new book, The Second Nuclear Age. Paul Bracken is the author of the previous books, Fire in the East and the Command and Control of Nuclear Weapons. He's a professor of management and political science at Yale and was previously a member of the senior staff of the Hudson Institute under Herman Kahn. It is my pleasure to welcome Paul Bracken to the program today to talk about the second nuclear age, strategy, danger, and the new power politics. Paul Bracken, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
It's good to have you here. One of the things you talk about is that we are perhaps a little too optimistic, that our view of the world really doesn't take into account the dangers that all of these nuclear powers today and ones that may emerge in the future, that they really present to us.
I believe that. I think there's two major reasons. First, one you identified a moment ago, which is that a lot of people thought these things were just drifting off into irrelevance, that nuclear weapons, that Russia and U.S. still had them, but they were not very relevant to international relations anymore. But I think there's another interesting feature what contributes to this sense of that everything's going to be okay, and that is the administrations in Washington, both Republican and Democrat, have gone out of their way to say that there's no real big problems here, that if we treat this as if we get people to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, you've had two presidents say that they feel that Pakistan's nuclear weapons are, quote, under control. I always thought that was an interesting one because I don't ever recall any president in the Cold War telling the American people that the Russian nuclear weapons were under control. So you have to ask why when a president says that, and I argue in the book, it's because they're not under control. They're not safely protected.
Is part of the problem that the lessons we learned from the Cold War with respect particularly to deterrence are still too fresh and that we just make the assumption that deterrence will be the operative principle?
Yes, I would say most academics who look at this, and that's another issue, that the number of academics who look at this is not many. It's hardly surprising since the Cold War is over with. But the argument is deterrence worked in the Cold War. It should work again. But it seems to me this is a sloppy way of putting it because it doesn't ask deterrence of what. I mean, I think deterrence of, say, a nuclear Iran hurling atom bombs at Israel, that could be strong, but then again, the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. We had many Cold War crises that could have escalated. And so what we have to deter is crises, provocations, things we haven't even thought of. And that's hard to do.
Is part of the problem also that nuclear weapons, almost as a technology, has become second rate? That cyber technology today, cyber warfare, and the advances in conventional weapons has made nuclear weapons almost obsolete.
They've made them obsolete for the United States, but if you're a country such as North Korea, Iran, you cannot possibly hope to compete with the United States in conventional technologies. And that's one of the big reasons that they've gone down the nuclear route. The way I put it in the Second Nuclear Age book is that North Korea, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, other countries, they don't want to make the world safe for U.S. strong-arm tactics using conventional weapons. We have, by far, the best military in the world for conventional forces. And that's precisely the reason that they want to go nuclear, because they cannot hope to counter it.
And to what extent does the United States play a significant role in this multi-nuclear world?
Well, we're obviously going to play a major role, whether we do it self-consciously or not. My view is that since 1991, when the Soviet Union disappeared, the U.S. has done everything in its power to push this argument that nuclear weapons have no use, you shouldn't get them, if you have them, you should give them up, and it's an argument that I fully support. I just see one small problem here. It hasn't convinced any other countries.
Mm-hmm.
All right. nobody has really given up nuclear weapons since South Africa, and that was tied to the whole apartheid racial thing of the majority taking hold in South Africa. So another way to think about this is if you look back over 200 years of American history, anti-nuclear policies have been more intensely pushed by a broad bipartisan supporting coalition of Republicans and Democrats and everybody else, more than any other policy in American history, more than the Monroe Doctrine, liberal internationalism, or containment in the Cold War. But I would still conclude that, unfortunately, it didn't work. We didn't convince China and Russia to cut their arsenals much. We didn't convince North Korea, Pakistan, and India. And it doesn't seem to me, as of today, we're convincing Iran.
And yet, in many cases, while we haven't gotten rid of a lot of our nuclear weapons, we've sort of let them decay a little bit. We've kept them less modernized than many other nations.
Well, that's very true. We in fact, the U.S. and Russians have had very large cuts from the peaks of the Cold War. Both are down about two-thirds in numbers of weapons. But I think the equally interesting issue is the atrophy, the rot of the nuclear forces. And when I say the rot, I mean they haven't been maintained, they have not been technologically modernized, and intellectually they're orphans that polite people in Washington and in universities and think tanks just choose not to talk about. So there hasn't been any realistic, even nuclear games for the officer corps to play in the last 20 years. And there's just so many examples of this. Some of your listeners may have seen this story of about, I think it was in 2 months ago, where an 83-year-old Catholic nun got through the security perimeter at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where the United States holds enriched uranium. It should be and was one of the most secure facilities in the United States. Well, the fact that she got through the fence because, guess what, the security cameras were not working that day. They had outsourced the contract to some company, to a low-cost bidder. And my point here is this is just one of many examples to show that even the U.S. government doesn't take the security of nuclear weapons seriously, yet alone their modernization.
Another aspect is the way in which many of these other nations view their nuclear weapons program. Even during the Cold War, we looked at it as part of and weapons of the Cold War itself. In many cases today, it's looked as a nationalistic aspect of these individual countries.
Well, during the Cold War, there was a large ideological conflict, which was the basis of the Cold War. That was the Cold War. It was democracy and liberal society versus communism. So if we ask, well, what's the replacement today? I think the replacement is nationalism, is the dominant ideology of the second nuclear age. Each country thinks it's the best. If it gets into domestic trouble, it will try to stoke domestic hostility. Think of this. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy didn't call for a million citizens to go into the Washington Mall or to Times Square to rally and demand the blood of Soviet leaders, because he knew that it would back him into a corner. He knew that it would intensify the crisis. Boy, do you see this all the time now. You see it in Cairo. You see it in southern Lebanon in the 2006 Lebanon War. You see it in China and India and Pakistan, and mostly Iran. So that nuclear decision-making, which used to be in the Cold War something that a handful of experts, possibly crazy experts if you look at the Dr. Strangelove movie, I'm not saying this was a good system or a golden age, but it was very different because it was not connected to mass sentiments on the street, which can change in an hour.
And one of the points you make is that in a multipolar nuclear world, we have to worry as much about our nuclear allies as our nuclear opponents.
Right, and let's not be too abstract here. There's a concrete case right now, and it's called Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So I urge that we really have to ask ourselves, is the problem supporting our allies and our interests, or should we step beyond the narrow American interest to prevent the use of nuclear weapons? The two objectives are different. we have to make it crystal clear that Israel should not use nuclear weapons. Or if we can't do that, maybe lower the standards a bit and say, well, you shouldn't use nuclear weapons first if somebody hasn't done that. And we really need to think that through. My fear is that it's something that people, when you hear it, you'll sort of agree with it. But if you haven't thought about it and planned for it, it's like agreeing that Hurricane Katrina could do a lot of damage to New Orleans when the hurricane's a half hour away.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make preparations for this.
And in many ways, this discussion of deterrence comes back to this, because it's who deters who. In the multipolar nuclear world, it's kind of an ongoing game of three-dimensional chess.
It is, and it's extremely complex. And using the old models, which are designed for a two-player game, Moscow and Washington, all of our arms control, all of our communications are designed for a two-player game. So, for example, I have a scenario in the book based on some war games I've seen, mm-hmm. in which China passes targeting information to Pakistan about India's nuclear forces. And the question it raises is, what does the U.S. do? If we haven't talked to China about this possibility in advance, and it happens, it could be very, very destabilizing.
And there is a psychological component to all of this, that nuclear weapons are used for nations to play essentially head games with each other.
Yes. What I call nuclear head games, which is when a leader tries to create illusions of what they might do if the enemy provoked them in certain ways. The academics tend to look at this by saying, well, should you play head games or not? What I point out is that every single president in the Cold War, from Harry Truman to George Bush, hawk, dove, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, every single one of them played these games. And we need to start cataloging how leaders in Pakistan and, yes, Israel and other countries are already playing them today. China, for example, is playing these games where she'll have some of her submarines with nuclear weapons suddenly disappear overnight, and we don't know where they are. And she knows this is picked up on U.S. satellites. You had Israel a few years ago sailing a submarine through the Suez Canal. This was when Hosni Mubarak was still in charge of Israel, and leaking the fact that it carried nuclear weapons aboard so that they could fire nuclear weapons at Iran from the Arabian Sea and not just the Mediterranean. Well, I'm not saying these head games are smart or good. I'm only making a more limited point. They're going to be played.
And to what extent does the anti-missile technology of today play a role in this?
Yeah, that's a very interesting one, because the U.S. is spending about $8 billion a year on missile defense, and it's a very troubled program. It's a very difficult technological problem. But I think missile defense is going to be a very important factor in the second nuclear age. Recall that the U.S. had signed something back in the Cold War called the ABM Treaty, which banned these weapons. Now, President Bush in 2002 or 2003 pulled the U.S. out of this treaty. Had he not done so, U.S. missiles, which are being deployed today to defend Turkey, Israel, Japan, and South Korea, would be banned by international agreement. We would not be able to defend our key allies if this treaty had stayed in force.
How does the role of containment impact this multipolar nuclear world today? And how is containment different from deterrence?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And there's a kind of sloppiness in language here. But deterrence is if the other side has the bomb and you threaten to retaliate in an unacceptable way. Containment adds another set of features, which is you won't let the other side benefit, for example, by selling nuclear weapons to another country, think Saudi Arabia, perhaps. And so the other side, you allow them to have nuclear weapons, but do you try to contain their influence? And many people think that what's going on now in the world is that the United States is engaging in what I would call soft acceptance of an Iranian nuclear weapon. That we will never say it. We will not say that we're going to accept it and contain it, because we promised not to do that. but we'll take only very limited actions, only up to a point, and then say, well, we did our best to stop Iran from getting the bomb, but what else could we do? I'm not saying this is what will the outcome be, but this is widely what many people in Europe and in the Middle East think the real U.S. policy is, soft acceptance of an Iranian nuclear bomb. Just go through the efforts doing your best effort to stop it, knowing that it's probably not going to be stopped.
And part of that soft acceptance comes from what? What is it in U.S. policy that makes that viable?
I think mainly it comes from the difficulty of stopping Iran from getting the bomb. Nobody has come up with very good ideas for stopping Iran, short of a military attack, which I would argue would have to be a lot bigger than most people think. I think another factor, less important today, but a few years ago was very important, that there's, and many of your listeners will find this difficult to believe, but there's many academics and people in think tanks who believe that nuclear weapons have no uses, that they're an outmoded technology of the Cold War, and that if Iran got them, it wouldn't make any difference. Needless to say, that's not my view.
And Israel's policy, we talked about Israel's policy, which was really designed at a time when Israel was the only nuclear power in the region, and they haven't really adjusted their strategy to this multipolar nuclear world.
That's right, and I'm not aware of any other book that goes into this in any detail of what Israel's nuclear strategy is and how they've come to grips with it. But for the past 40 years, mainly what Israel has had to do was to make sure that nobody puts a picture of these things, of Israel's nuclear weapons, in the New York Times, because that would cause such a controversy. And they've been extremely successful at that, but it has narrowed their focus of attention to a set of issues which has been easy to prevent a picture in the newspapers, and they haven't really had the kind of deep, soul-searching debates the way the United States did, well, in the early Cold War, when we had to think about nuclear weapons. I recall at first they were sort of, the thinking was pretty much run by the Pentagon, but then you had these very interesting think tanks and names from the past, like Herman Kahn and Henry Kissinger, who built their early careers breaking the Pentagon's monopoly on the conversation. You didn't have to agree with their criticism, but you sort of had to agree with that they made the debate be conducted at a higher level by introducing political and moral factors and not just narrow military considerations into U.S. policy on nuclear weapons.
You said something before which goes to the heart of this, and perhaps even more so today, that it's just not something people in polite company want to talk about.
No, it's in polite company. If I go to Washington in the last few years and I use the word nuclear, the next word had better be nonproliferation or disarmament. If I talk about nuclear strategy that Israel, North Korea, Pakistan have the bomb and they're damn glad they have it, this violates the sensibility that nuclear weapons have no use. Now, this is changing. And it's going to change very quickly when Iran gets the bomb. But it shows how isolated American thinking on the bomb has been. It's almost, nuclear weapons issues in the academic world, on universities, it is treated, but it is treated almost entirely as a problem of nuclear nonproliferation or disarmament. The notion that Israel would use these weapons, what that use might look like, and how the U.S. should respond, is not considered an acceptable topic of discussion.
To what extent are we going to see a continued arms race among these nations right now?
You're going to see a major arms race, and that's what I call the first bounce of the nuclear ball. Take South Asia. You have Pakistan and India building up the factories that make fissile material, uranium-235 and plutonium. And they're only beginning to crank out this fissile material, but they will do it. In Pakistan's case, you're going to see a far larger number of what we used to call tactical, that is, battlefield nuclear weapons. I bet many of your listeners are unaware that the fastest growing nuclear power in the world today is Pakistan. All of the experts in the U.S. said that Pakistan was going to stop at 60 weapons. Now she's doubled that in the last 5 years. And they're engaging in other tactics like making these forces super alert. India is deploying some very sophisticated satellites, intelligence sensors that she puts on airplanes. And if you ask yourself, why are they doing this, it is almost surely to locate Pakistan's nuclear weapons. And why do you want to locate the nuclear weapons of the other side? Because you may have to fire on them.
India and Pakistan really do seem to be the heart of this second nuclear age.
I would say that, yes, but they're a good race for second place between Iran and Israel is right there.
Where does China fit in this equation today?
Yeah, China has a relatively small nuclear force, unless we're off by a lot. And I would point out the history of being off in these estimates is quite high. We're usually very far off. But China is deploying a whole new generation of mobile nuclear weapons, weapons to be put on submarines, to be put on mobile missiles rather than in fixed silos. And this introduces all kinds of new Chinese strategies. We tend to focus, when we talk about deterrence and these questions, of countries hurling hydrogen bombs back at each other, and it all seems so unrealistic. But let's drop down at the level of intensity for China. Suppose there's a crisis over the islands, as occurred 2 weeks ago, these disputed islands near the Philippines, and China responds by going on a nuclear alert. This will be picked up by U.S. satellites immediately, and I would guess 10 minutes later it'll be on every website in the world. China can now nuclearize a small crisis. And I can't imagine the U.S. considering going to nuclear war over these pecks of sand in the Western Pacific. So I think what they're doing is exactly what Henry Kissinger said China would do in his last book, which is maneuvering for temporary local advantage using nuclear weapons. Not firing nuclear weapons, but using them for communications, bargaining, and threats.
We have 9 nuclear states now. How many might we have 10 years from now?
I don't see the number skyrocketing to what, you know, President Kennedy once said, like 25. I can see maybe 12, 15, possibly 20 if you're really pessimistic. Kennedy was talking about 25 nuclear weapon states in the late 70s, and that was clearly a gross estimate. We don't know where he got that. It's interesting, we actually have the study that was given to him by the Pentagon, and they were much more conservative in their estimate.
Is there any discussion in the Pentagon about these issues, about things other than just non-proliferation?
There has been, until very recently, virtually no discussion of this. There is now some discussions which I would say are verbal and back-channel. Since putting anything about nuclear weapons on paper in terms of using them or how others might use them and what the United States would do is so politically incorrect that it will get you into trouble. But to answer your question, the military is certainly thinking about, oh, my God, we might actually have to face one of these countries using nuclear weapons. What would we do next?
Paul Bracken. His book is The Second Nuclear Age, Strategy, Danger, and the New Power Politics. Paul, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Good to be here.
Thank you.